The Second Iteration. 16. Eli'd never been anywhere so dark before. No houses, no streetlights, no moon, only a few faint stars that didn't seem to cast any actual light. The whole world had faded away as the car drove on, leaving nothing but a few dashboard lights and a bright oval of pavement. He glanced over at Harry. They hadn't spoken in almost half an hour. Even then, it had just been 20 minutes of back and forth, apologies from her and denial from him. Denial that, even he had to admit, had gotten a bit pleading at the end. He cleared his throat. "Are we going to stop for the night?" Harry glanced at him.
"I hadn't planned on it."
"Are you good to keep driving?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"You aren't tired or road blind or anything?" She raised an eyebrow.
"Road blind?"
"Sometimes when I have to do a lot of driving, I zone out and go on automatic, just sort of lose focus and then realize I haven't really registered anything for the last 10 or 20 minutes, especially when it's monotonous, like this." He gestured out at the black.
"I know what you mean,"
she said.
"I've just never heard it referred to that way."
"Ah.
I am a bit road blind,"
Harry admitted.
"Road nearsighted, perhaps.
Do you want me to drive for a while?" Her eyes flicked toward him in the dark.
"Have you ever driven a Model A before, Mr. Teague?"
Eli shifted on the wooden bench. "Once, but the owner was walking me through it. We never even left the parking lot."
"I think we'll preserve her gearbox for a bit longer then,"
Harry said, patting the steering wheel. They came up over a rise and a cluster of red lights appeared in the distance. A big truck plowing its way across the desert. Harry swung the wheel, brought them up alongside, and then passed it. She reached an arm out and waved as they settled in ahead of the truck. Two quick baas from the big rig's horn echoed behind them. Eli glanced back. They were already past the circle of the truck's headlights. He squinted at the dashboard.
"How fast are we going?" "About 70. The steering gets wonky past that, so I prefer not to go faster in the dark."
He leaned back and studied the car's dash in the dim light. Harry had added a wooden dashboard over the classic metal one, putting some space between herself and the back wall of the gas tank. A not uncommon rebuild for a Model A. She'd carried over the steel clover of instruments the Model A classically had. The cylinder speedometer and gas gauge. The ignition key had been replaced by a series of silver switches. 9 other switches had been added next to the clover in a 3x3 grid. The small orange light, now calm and dark, sat at the top of the clover, just above the gas gauge. She'd created an interesting design, keeping it balanced even though the car hadn't been designed with much of a dashboard. "How fast can it go?"
"She can get close to 90 on a straightaway,"
said Harry.
"The speedometer only goes to 75, though."
Eli smiled. "A 1929 Model A business coupe that hits 90 miles per hour."
"Stranger things in heaven and earth,"
she said. "You've made other modifications, haven't you? Past the carburetor."
"A few, yes. A carbon fiber timing gear, some better electrics. But that's nothing new. People customized Model A's for decades, yes?"
They drove on in the darkness. A car appeared in the distance. It flashed its headlights, high-low, high-low, as it approached. Then it roared past them in a gust of sound and wind. "Can I ask you another question?"
"I suppose it depends,"
said Harry.
"What about?"
He gestured at the steering column. "Your car."
"Then, yes, Mr. Teague, you may ask a question."
"The car has a Garrett carburetor." She glanced at him.
"Yes."
"How?"
"How did we get a carburetor?"
"How did you get one that runs on water?" Harry sighed.
"Someone revisits the idea in 2027, 28. The original conversion was done in 2029, and then we had the carburetor upgraded in 2034.
The dates went back and forth in Eli's mind. He tried to think of all the things that could have been invented in the years till 2027.
"Garrett's basic design is fairly correct,"
she continued.
He just didn't have the right materials. Imagine if you tried to make a catalytic converter with wood and ceramics. It wouldn't function, but that wouldn't mean the basic idea of a catalytic converter is flawed.
Eli let his breath huff out through his nose. Two more miles slipped by under the Model A's wheels.
Okay, then, he said. What about this? Why not just get a better car?
Harry's eyes gleamed wide in the dark.
Better how?
She patted the steering wheel again.
Ignore him, girl.
If you can travel into the future, Eli asked, why not get, I don't know, a flying car or something? I thought the future was going to be all electric cars and jetpacks and stuff.
She snorted.
And what would I do with your fancy automobile when it ran out of electrical charge in 1830? How would I repair it when it broke down in 1787? How could I replace batteries or motors or computer-chipped ignition keys? After 1985, automobiles just become too complicated. Too many things to go wrong.
Her fingers flexed on the steering wheel.
Older is better. Anything goes wrong with Eleanor, I can fix 99% of it with a crescent wrench and a hammer. Tools I can carry with me.
That kind of makes sense.
In addition,
she said, sounding like a school teacher,
there's the blending in issue. Old automobiles are an oddity, but they stand out much less than future ones. There's almost 130 years of American history where a Model A barely rates a second glance. Something like a Tesla Model X, though? That's going to stick out like a sore thumb. There's barely 3 decades where it won't attract attention.
Another mile vanished beneath Eleanor's wheels. If blending in and attracting attention are real issues, said Eli, maybe you should rethink your wardrobe? He saw the tricorn tip down for a moment.
Frock coats are worn for almost 200 years, Mr. Teague,
she said.
Even in eras when they're not fashionable, they're not unheard of garments.
Even for women?
As I mentioned earlier, the unfortunate truth is that most of American history is not terribly friendly to women, especially those traveling alone. When we first met and you mistook me for a young man, it was not entirely because of your own ignorance.
Thanks, I guess.
It's a camouflage which has helped me more than once since I started traveling the road on my own.
Sorry, he said.
For what? That you have to,
I don't know, put up with that?
That you have to hide who you are?
It's the way things are. There's no point apologizing for the past. We can only learn from it and try to be better.
Eleanor skimmed over a few more miles. It crossed Eli's mind that, aside from being unnaturally fast, the car ran smoothly on the road. His infrequent experience with Model A's before this had been a lot like trying to ride one of those massage chairs they sold in the big shopping malls over in Newington. Harry yawned. She bit it off at the end and glanced in Eli's direction.
Pardon me,
he yawned himself.
Are you sure you're okay to drive?
I'm just fine,
she nodded too enthusiastically.
Don't worry about me.
A thought wiggled into his mind. He cleared his throat. Is this because of me being here? Her fingers shifted on the steering wheel.
Truth be told,
she said,
we hardly know each other, Mr. Teague. It would be a bit improper, and all too forward for me to suggest we, well, that we...
Sleep?
Sleep,
she agreed.
Together. Sad to say, the only real clue I have of your character is from when you were a teenage boy.
I've grown up since then.
Yes,
she said.
Yes, you have.
Another mile of highway rolled by.
If you want to stop for the night, Eli said, I'll sleep on the ground and you can sleep here in the car.
Harry coughed out a grim laugh.
I don't know if you've noticed,
she said,
but it's almost impossible to sleep in here.
You have my word, he said. You've got nothing to worry about from me.
He thought about it, then added,
Miss Pritchard.
The shadows beneath her nose shifted back and forth, up and down.
Very well,
she said. She glanced back over her shoulder.
There's been no sign of them. We're probably safe for now.
The rumble of the Model A's engine dropped an octave. She guided them closer to the edge of the road. The point of the tricorn turned toward the road's shoulder. What are you looking for?
A good place to pull over for the night. No big stones or deep ditches.
Eli looked out at the rolling desert. Is there a reason we can't find a motel? She barked out a laugh.
Even these days, that's $10 or $15 a night.
I've still got some cash,
which won't be printed for another 20 or 30 years at best. You'd best get used to living tight, Mr. Teague. It's been at least 6 weeks since I slept on a mattress.
A few different thoughts bounced through Eli's head, which he chose to voice with a simple, "Ah." Eleanor slowed, and after cruising for another 2 miles, they found a spot Harry deemed acceptable. The Model A rolled off the pavement and onto the hard-packed dirt. It continued on for 70 or 80 feet, carrying them far clear of the highway. Harry flicked a few switches, and the car shuddered to a stop.
"Here we are,"
she said. She gestured at the outside. Eli nodded. "You know, after a week of sleeping on buses and trains, the ground doesn't look that bad." Harry pushed the door open, slipped out, and reached back to pull a battered olive-green bag from behind the bench. A duffel bag. Or a rucksack. He wasn't sure what the correct term was for the upright bag.
"Not just the ground, Mr. Teague. When you travel with me, you get all the luxuries."
She wiggled the clip loose on the rucksack, unfolded the top, and pulled out a wool blanket.
"Would you like brown or gray?"
"Is there a difference?"
"The gray one also has some black stripes."
He managed a smile. "Whichever one you don't want." Harry tugged out a gray blanket and tossed it at him. She walked a few feet from the car, a slim shadow in the dark. The bag dropped to the ground and she swung her blanket into the air to open it. Eli kicked a few stones into the night and spread his blanket on the ground a few yards from hers. The wool was thick enough to hide most of the bumps. He stretched out on one side and tugged the other half over himself as best he could. It wasn't a sleeping bag, but it created a pocket of warmth in the cool night air. On the other side of Eleanor, a big truck roared by on the highway. They were far enough off the road to muffle the sound of its engine. The headlights raced away, a cloud of light sliding across the desert, never reaching the Model A. Eli wondered if it was the one they'd passed a while ago, and tried to remember if they'd passed an exit or off-ramp of some kind. Harry shrugged off her coat and balled it into a pillow. She stretched out a few yards away from him, lying on her side, with her head far from his. She reached back and pulled the extra blanket up over herself. The quiet stretched between them, broken by a car zooming by. Then another big truck. He could tell she wasn't asleep. Her breathing wasn't right. "Nice blankets," said Eli. "Good weight." She made a sound almost like a grunt. "I hate light blankets. You should be able to feel a blanket sitting on you."
"They're from an Army-Navy surplus store in Tulsa,"
she said.
"Somewhere around 1993, if memory serves."
He thought about it, then repeated the year aloud.
"Yes,"
she said, and echoed it back to him. "So you really travel in time?"
"In history,"
she said.
"And yes."
"And we're in the 1960s right now?"
"We still are."
Another big rig drove by on the freeway, headed west, back toward California. "Can I ask another question?" She let out a sigh.
"Of course."
"Your old partner, Chris." Harry twisted on her blanket, turning to face him. Her eyes glinted in the night.
"He preferred Christopher. He considered Chris to be such a common name."
Eli waited a moment. "You talk about him in the past tense."
"Mr. Teague,"
she said,
"you may have noticed I have not brought this topic up before."
"Carefully danced around it," Eli agreed.
"What does that tell you?"
"Sorry. What happened to him?" She sighed in the dark.
"What do you think? They killed him."
"Ah. Sorry.
It was a long time ago."
"I'm still sorry."
"Thank you."
The shadowy blob of her blanket shifted again as another truck drove by back on the highway.
"Get a good night's rest. We have a long way to drive tomorrow."
He felt a yawn build and let it out. After sleeping upright in seats for so many nights, the firm ground felt remarkably comfortable, and the blanket luxurious. Sleep tugged at his eyelids, and he welcomed it.
Mr. Teague.
Yeah?
It's Mrs. Pritchard, not Miss.
Oh, he said. He woke up a bit more and said, Oh, sorry.
I wanted to be sure that was clear,
she said.
I apologize for any confusion.
Yeah, of course. He thought of asking another question, decided against it, and then sleep dragged him back down.
Good night, Mr. Teague,
her voice whispered out of the dark. 17. The voices swam in, circled his mind, and prodded him awake.
Not an average case, said the faceless doctor. But I believe all the grafts should take well.
15 nodded.
When will he be ready for field work?
As soon as he wakes and has his orientation,
said the doctor.
And I believe he just woke up.
15 shifted his attention.
How do you feel?
He wondered how they knew he was awake when he hadn't moved or opened his eyes. He remembered something about people breathing differently when they were awake and wondered if he'd been snoring or something. Maybe he could get a little more sleep if he didn't react. They might leave him alone. 15 spoke again.
I know you're awake. Please don't waste any more time.
He ignored the faceless man standing at the side of the bed with arms crossed. 10 more minutes would be a victory. It'd show 15 who... How did he know where and how 15 stood when he hadn't opened his eyes? Why couldn't he think of his own name? Why couldn't he open his eyes? In the back of his mind, he remembered being forced to sign the contract, the scrawl of his signature, his heart speeding, his breath coming in fast gasps. He remembered the faint chemical smell of the gas as it hissed into the mask, and he pulled it in through his nose. Why couldn't he open his eyes? He flexed the muscles of his face, felt his cheeks and forehead tighten. His head thrashed side to side, and he tried to rub his eyes against his shoulder. Straps pulled tight on his wrists and across his chest as he moved.
This is normal, said 15. There are always a few moments of panic at first.
My eyes,
he started to say, but his mouth was all wrong. His jaw felt stiff. His tongue stayed still. His lips didn't. Once he realized the screams were his, he stopped. He turned his head to 15.
Why can't I remember my name? The procedure involves some grafts and transplants,
the doctor explained.
Some things are moved, others added, and still others removed. But why can't I remember my name?
He tried to adjust his face, to grit his teeth, but his features refused to move.
You're one of the faceless men, said 15. You don't have a name.
But I had one,
he said. 15 shook his head.
I did. I was...
It danced on the tip of his tongue.
My name was...
You don't have a name. You'll be assigned a number as identification is required on a case-by-case basis.
So who am I? What's my number?
You are zero.
What?
He tried to sit up and the straps pulled tight on his chest and wrists again.
You are zero, repeated 15. Every faceless man begins as zero to remind him he has no identity. Each of us is what we need to be to perform our duty, no more and no less.
A grumble settled in the back of Zero's throat, as did the awareness that he still had a throat.
You were Zero once?
15 nodded.
We all were. I have been 15 for the past 11 weeks. Before that, I was 23, and before that, 8, 16, 4, and other numbers as circumstances required.
Zero,
he repeated. It tickled his mind. Made the name on the tip of his tongue dance just a little harder. Not quite right, but close enough.
How can I see you?
You can't. You don't have eyes. You're one of the faceless men.
But you're right there.
Yes, agreed 15 with a nod.
So, how do I know that if I can't see you?
Through certainty, said the faceless man.
What's that mean?
The phrase lacked something, a word he'd used all the time, a very flexible adjective, sometimes a verb, one of his favorites.
Have you ever walked through a familiar room at night? You can still move with confidence, step around objects, reach for light switches or remotes. Sometimes you even notice that something's different.
Zero nodded.
Yeah, okay.
That's how we see. We are sure of everything, so we move with certainty.
There was more to it. Zero felt certain, but he accepted the faceless man's explanation. This felt out of character for him. Before, he would have demanded more, demanded with the words he could no longer remember. How much had they cut out of him? Enough that it didn't bother him. Not at the moment. He'd deal with it later.
Let me up.
Let yourself up, said 15. And be quick. We have work to do.
Zero turned his attention to the straps that held him down. The buckles sat out of reach, just under the lip of the gurney. The straps, he remembered them as heavy canvas, but they seemed thin, inconsequential. He stopped struggling against the straps and just sat up. They popped and tore and dropped away. He reached down and ripped aside the lower ones with a sweep of his hand and swung his legs off the gurney. His feet hit the floor, and he stood before the faceless man.
Excellent, said 15.
Zero became certain of the frayed threads at the torn edges of the straps, and the ripples of the sheet on the gurney also splattered with blood, and the tray of instruments which had been pushed back, the 21 pieces of bloody gauze in a wire trash bin, the tank which contained anesthetic gas, the green gauge on the tank which had a black needle pointing precisely at the line after one quarter, the hose on the tank leading to the rubber mask, 14 drops of condensation inside the mask. The room leaned to the side, as if he'd had a few too many Boilermakers. He tried to close eyes he didn't have as more information poured into his mind. He grabbed the edge of the gurney behind him and willed himself to be as solid as it. His level of certainty dropped. The glut of detail faded away. Zero straightened up. 15 observed it all. He nodded. Then he turned away and walked out the big swinging doors. Zero followed him into the hallway. They entered a locker room, and Zero went to a locker. It wasn't his, he knew. He didn't have enough of an identity to claim ownership of anything. Not anymore. But he understood the locker had been prepared for him, one of the many facts of which he was now certain. Arranged inside, he found shoes, a shirt, and a dark gray three-piece suit, almost black. Brown paper wrappers held black socks, a white t-shirt, and plain boxers. The tie was a deep red, like blood when it first swelled up from a wound. It had a pattern in the fabric to give it texture. The vest took a long time. He buttoned it crooked on the first try, and it had a lot of buttons. At least as many as the shirt, maybe more. He almost tossed it back inside the locker, but such a show of temper didn't feel right anymore. It had been a long time since he'd had to knot a real necktie, but after his first attempt, he became certain how the band of silk needed to loop and fold. He snuggled it against his throat and looked as sharp and badass as 15. Yes, badass. He left the coat on its hanger, closed the locker, and turned to 15.
How do we get started?
You forgot your coat.
Are we heading out?
15 paused.
No, he said. Not yet. Why?
I don't want to wear the coat inside.
he said.
I'll be too warm.
Again, his words felt wrong. Edited, they lacked the passionate emphasis he enjoyed. 15 didn't move, then nodded once. They walked back into the hall side by side. Partners, even if Zero still needed to get his bearings. He took a dozen steps and had to set a hand against the wall. Knowledge of the hall poured into his mind. Details, history, facts flooded his consciousness. The wall was simple and solid. He tried to draw that solidity out of it. 15 waited.
It is, said Zero. A lot to get used to.
It is, agreed the other faceless man.
They returned to the main room. Faceless men filled the space, every square foot of floor. Everything about them echoed and repeated. He could sense every iteration, pick out every detail of each version. Zero tried to close his eyes again, then he reached up and covered the front of his head with his hands. Nothing changed. He let out a frustrated grunt.
It can be overwhelming, said 15. All the new perceptions. The influx of information. I took almost 2 weeks to adjust. Some men take days, a few have needed over a month.
Okay.
Zero tried to take a breath. His lungs fluttered, his throat twitched, but no air flowed. He panicked, his heart raced. He tried even harder to suck in air, and then he remembered he didn't have a mouth. His chest muscles spasmed and fought with his lungs. He forced himself to straighten up, willed his chest and stomach to stop pumping at his lungs. He wouldn't look weak in front of the new boss. He wouldn't mess this up. Just like before a game, no nerves, no worries. His body responded.
You're doing very well, 15 said.
Thanks. Thank you.
Two faceless men moved past in the other direction, one pushing something. Zero sensed the angles, the closing gap, the pace of their strides, but he couldn't turn the certainty into motion before his elbow connected with a heavy slap of muscle and bone. His body felt sluggish and clumsy as waves of unfamiliar sensory input hit him again and again. He managed to not stagger and kept himself alongside 15. Then someone behind him yelled,
Hey, Nimrod!
He stopped. 15 stopped next to him. They turned at the same time. Zero wasn't sure who had started the move, if one of them followed the other. The other two men stood a few yards away, except there were three men. The two standing were faceless men, with a normal human, eyes, nostrils, mouth, hair, seated in a wheelchair, strapped in a wheelchair. His new senses ebbed, swirled, crashed over him again, and Zero recognized the people who stood before him.
That was me, he said.
Damn straight it was, moron,
snapped the man with a face.
Hitting a guy in a wheelchair? What the fuck's wrong with you? Watch where you're going.
Watch. Zero remembered being over there, on the other side of the conversation, where he hoped nobody would notice he'd told a man with no eyes to watch it, and he could sense the underlying panic, the fear that he'd gone too far, threatened a monster. He was a loser. Had been a loser.
It's not important. 15 told him. He doesn't matter anymore.
The faceless man set a hand on Zero's shoulder and applied pressure. It helped him focus and guided him away from the confrontation and deeper into the crowd.
What's that supposed to mean?
Yelled someone behind him. Someone who wasn't important.
Hey, I'm talking to you, jackass!
Zero tried to calm his thoughts as they thrashed in the churning waves of input.
Did you know that was us? Before?
Yes,
said 15.
Why didn't you say anything?
What was there to say?
You could have told me not to hit him.
The faceless man shook his head.
I couldn't.
Why?
Because you hit him in the side of the head, said 15. We both observed it and remembered it.
So?
You can't avoid something that already happened. We are not exempt from the rules.
But it hadn't happened to me.
It had, both sides. You saw it.
That doesn't make sense.
15 raised a hand to the room.
The history of the faceless men, of the country, is all happening right here, right now. All of it. It will happen. It has happened. We know all of the events and all of the outcomes, especially here. We have certainty.
The words brought all new thoughts and facts to the surface of Zero's seething perceptions. He grabbed them, held on tight as they tried to slip back under the waves of input.
Wait,
he said. He stopped and stepped to the left to avoid a pair of faceless men going the other way.
The dream. The American dream. Our purpose. Did you know all along it was going to be stolen?
Of course we did. From the day the Home Office was founded. We know all the events and all the outcome.
And you didn't do anything? I would have had every version of every man here armed and standing around the thing.
Precautions were taken, said 15, even with the potential risk to causality. They made no difference, as we knew they wouldn't. The dream was taken.
That's just pathetic.
The faceless man's head shifted.
Excuse me?
You knew a crime was going to happen. A crime against the United States, and you just let it happen. I think that's the definition of pathetic.
15's punch slammed into his chest. Zero slid back and crashed into a desk. The faceless men around him froze.
Do not ever, roared 15. Think to question the ability or dedication of either this office or the men who serve it.
Zero pushed himself back to his feet.
I was just saying—
You will say nothing!
15 stalked forward and loomed over the smaller man.
You are nothing. Don't forget that. You're Zero for a reason.
Thoughts and awareness and perceptions raged in Zero's head. Blurry half-memories of how he'd react to such words, even without the assault. Just recently, someone had taken an uppity attitude and he'd... Why couldn't he remember? Part of him, a small part, screamed at the fact that he'd been lessened. They'd cut so much of him away, he wasn't even sure what was gone. He had no context. He had less of everything. He brushed the voice away, or as far away as he could. The uppity person hadn't even been important, a minor distraction in the past, before he'd become one of the faceless men. She'd only been important because of the reason he'd been recruited, the one thing he'd hung on to. Zero looked up at 15.
Where?
He said.
Where is Eli Teague?
18. Eleanor's tires spun, grabbed at dirt that had been pavement a moment earlier, and pulled them out of the second skid in as many minutes. Eli's stomach recovered from the lurch and took the moment to remind him he hadn't had anything close to a solid meal since the greasy biscuits at breakfast 7 or 8 hours ago. The grumble faded, even as he steadied himself. How did time travel affect stomach clocks? Maybe that was how time travelers told time. The cold hit him like stepping into a freezer, an abrupt drop of temperature, and it kept dropping.
Jesus,
he muttered, pulling his arms tight to his body.
I did warn you,
Harry said. She wore a new shirt under her vest, an ivory one that buttoned up almost to her chin and had ruffles like an old tuxedo.
You said it'd get cold. I wasn't expecting high 70s to low 20s in half a second. Be prepared, Mr. Teague. Don't tell me you were never a Boy Scout.
The road wandered through the forest like a drunk. It didn't seem to be maintained in any way below the dusting of snow, just beaten down by years of travel. To emphasize Eli's observation, Eleanor's tires kicked up a rock that thudded beneath the floorboards. A few miles off, at least a dozen thin columns of smoke curled up into the air. The smell of burning wood and coal reached through the cold air to tickle his nose. Harry steered the Model A off the road and parked behind a cluster of tall weeds that probably could have been called saplings. Snow dusted their brown leaves and branches. They walked back to the road. A few slow, lazy flakes drifted past Eli's face. He'd known many days like this in Maine. Cold enough to snow and sap your heat, not quite cold enough for it to last. As a kid, it was the kind of snow he'd hated. Not enough to cancel school or even to be fun when he got out of school. He stamped his feet twice and rubbed his hands together. Like most New Englanders, he had a set of gloves and a spare wool hat in his car. His car was about 1,000 miles away, though. He also guessed at least 100 years would pass before it was actually built. At least he'd kept his wool socks and had real shoes on instead of sneakers. He pointed at the smoke.
"Is that it? Independence?"
She nodded.
"And we're in 1850? Unless I missed it, 1853. Independence is a challenging one. For about 20 years, it was the place tens of thousands of people wanted to be."
She tugged a cloak out from behind the bench and wrapped it over her frock coat.
"So it's one of those towns you talked about, one of the ones that got stuck in time?" "It was,"
she agreed.
"The perfect slick spot. Then the gold rush dries up, the Transcontinental Railroad is finished, and history gets its teeth into the town again. So it's a slick spot, but only during that 20-year period. We had to go back to a point where we could get to this point."
Eli nodded slowly.
"I think I get it."
Harry mashed her tricorn down on her head and gave him a once-over.
"Your clothes should pass,"
she told him.
"Put the wristwatch in your pocket. Try to keep the cuffs of your pants over your shoes. Not wearing boots out here will attract attention."
He shoved the watch into his coat. "Anything else?" She looked him up and down.
"That'll do for now."
They headed into town. Trails of dark, slushy mud in the snow, and a few small piles Eli felt sure weren't mud, helped mark off the road. Countless hooves and wagon wheels had pounded it more or less flat, but the mud froze in uneven ridges and furrows that could wrench an ankle.
"How do you know?"
asked Eli.
"Know what? That we're in 1853.
She turned around to face him and took a few steps backward.
"Are you suddenly doubting again, Mr. Teague?"
He shook his head.
"I mean, how do you get us here? Or now, I guess. How do you get us exactly now and not in 1852 or 54 or the middle of summer or something?"
Harry shrugged.
"Practice."
"You said it's not the car. Eleanor's just a regular Model A."
"She is. It's just about knowing how and where to drive, when to brake, how to steer the wheel."
"But how?" Harry turned back to the road.
"Do you know how to ride a bicycle?"
"What?"
"How to ride a bicycle."
"Yeah, of course."
"How do you do it? How do you balance? How do you steer without tipping over?"
He opened his mouth, shut it, then sighed.
"Practice." "Exactly."
They trudged toward the distant buildings. The air nipped at Eli's face and seeped into his clothes. His coat kept out the worst of it, and a few drafts slinked down to pool in his shoes. He paused after 10 minutes to stamp his feet again, and felt vindicated when Harry stamped hers, too.
"Are you looking for another clue here?"
he asked.
"Of course."
"Is it hidden in town?" She glanced over her shoulder.
"It, Mr. Teague?"
"The clue."
"We're looking for a man,"
she said.
"Not a treasure map."
"Ah." He rubbed his hands against his sides to warm them, then shoved them back into his coat pockets. Harry reached up and tugged the point of her tricorn to the left. The slanted shadow across her face shifted to keep the sun out of her eyes. Her hand slipped back inside her cloak.
"That's a neat trick," said Eli.
She glanced at him, then up at the folded brim.
"Learned it from a sharpshooter in 1802,
she said.
"You could use his hat for a sundial."
Eli chuckled. "So this guy we're looking for, do you have a name or a description or something?"
His name is Gregson Edgar Rusk, she said. He's a somewhat successful prospector. He has black hair, a big bushy beard, and one of his front teeth is broken. He's spending most of his time in two different saloons, drinking and...
She kicked at a rock, jutting from the snow. It flipped over twice as it slid through the muck, then came to rest. They walked past it. Eli cleared his throat. Drinking and...
Let's just say he's been alone for some time, and now he isn't on a regular basis.
Ah, said Eli. Got it. That all sounds pretty specific. Shouldn't be too hard to find him. Harry snorted.
Here and now, not so much.
She waved her arm behind them, then forward at the town.
This is the California Trail. It starts here in Independence and leads almost every settler and prospector out to gold territory or back here to proper civilization.
They walked on for another few minutes. He glanced back down the road but couldn't see the trees where they'd hidden the car. On a guess, they were more than halfway to town. He rubbed his knuckles against his chest before burying them in his pockets. So what do we need to talk to,
Gregson Edgar Rusk.
Right. What do we need to talk to him about?
Same thing as always,
she said.
About a dream.
She reached up and tugged her scarf higher, covering her nose and mouth. What makes you think the dream would be here?
Oh, I don't think it is,
said Harry.
I think he was influenced by the dream before he struck out on his journey. It's what put him on the right path.
Okay, kind of makes sense.
So we need to find out when he got on that path. Theo told me he struck it rich out in California, and I backtracked him to here.
And then from here to the dream?
Perhaps. That's the hope.
Is this what all the searchers do, hunt for clues?
More or less. We each have our own methods and strategies.
Eli stopped to stamp his feet two more times and also held his hands over his mouth to blow warm air on the palms and back onto his nose. A breeze slid through his jeans and set off a shiver that worked its way into his thighs. So, how'd Theo know about him? Rusk.
His specialty was information and rumors about the dream. That's why I met him in Boston.
Oh.
Oh?
He shrugged. I thought he sent you to Pasadena. She shook her head.
That was a personal matter, just a message he passed on. I'd backtracked my leads to Mr. Rusk, and Theo found some useful background material for me.
How?
Keeping his ears open, asking questions. Calling in the odd favor when and where. Theo had friends and informants all over.
As they reached the first buildings of town, a man appeared on a horse. A thick overcoat draped over his shoulders, and a hat of gray fur matched the shaggy hair poking out beneath it. He approached, passed with a nod to each of them, and headed back along the road. Eli glanced over his shoulder at the man as they headed into town. You worried about him?
Why would I be?
He's heading for the car.
He's heading for Kansas City,
Harry said.
In this weather, he won't waste time wandering off the road. If he happens to catch a glimpse of Eleanor in the bushes, he'll just think she's an odd-looking carriage.
They entered the town. Small and simple buildings lined the outskirts, some of them a step or two above being shacks. They reached a cross street, and a board by the door of a larger barn-like building had two horseshoes nailed to it. A few people walked around and alongside and past them. They wore long coats and shawls, and one man had what looked like a deer skin wrapped around himself. A few of the women stared at Harry, but only for a moment or two. Eli drew more eyes. Harry turned, smiled widely at him, and grabbed his arm. She pointed at another store window, this one marked Zion Mercantile.
Calm down,
she murmured to him. He looked at the window, then back at her close face. A few inches separated their noses. What? She kept the smile wide and squeezed his arm.
You're staring at everyone and everything like it's all new. Just act naturally.
His eyes flitted around at the buildings and the people, and then came back to her face. He took in a breath, held it, and let it back out. Okay, he said. Sorry.
No need to apologize,
said Harry, just loud enough to be heard. The smile faded as the grip on his arm eased. She led him to the next cross street. At the corner, a wooden pole stood on the railing of a porch. Faded and chipped stripes of red, white, and blue paint twisted around the pole. A team of horses trotted by, pulling a weather-beaten coach. Eli stepped back, and the equally weather-beaten man at the reins gave him a slight glance. The coach made it to the next block, weaving on the snowy road, before a whip snapped, and the horses picked up the pace.
If Theos got all these contacts and information, Eli asked, why doesn't he just use them himself?
She gestured at a shop window.
Why don't the people selling shovels just go mine gold themselves? It's not where his skills are. Were. He helped to find the dream in his own way.
But he still charges for it.
Not as much as some. Theo just tried to keep his business running. He wasn't one of those greedy money-grubbing weasels like Tico or...
Tico?
Chinese black marketeer. Started in San Francisco. Got on the road. Parts, tools, fuel, whatever you need. As long as you can meet his terms.
Harry looked to her left, then her right. She pulled an envelope from her pocket and unfolded it into a sheet of coarse paper. A few dozen short, handwritten lines marked it. More of a list than a letter, Eli decided.
Mr. Rusk frequents two saloons on this side of town, she said. We need to figure out where they are.
She glanced back over her shoulder, then squinted at the handwritten notes again.
I think that's Union Street? So this would be Ruffner.
Eli stomped his feet again. Icy needles pricked at his toes and calves and thighs. Is one of the saloons nearby? Harry looked up from the paper and glanced down each street again.
I believe so, she said. Cold?
Yeah. Not freezing, but definitely cold.
Don't mess this up for me and I'll get you a hat.
She studied his face.
You'd look good in a derby.
Sorry? She moved her hands back and forth around an imaginary dome and nodded.
A derby. A bowler hat.
He smiled. And blend in as well as you?
Don't believe all your Western films, Mr. Teague. The derby was the most popular hat in America for over a century. Even in the Wild West, it was worn far more than the cowboy hat.
Or the tricorn.
Don't be rude. That won't get you a hat either.
She pointed down the street.
This way.
They walked past another dozen buildings. The homes and businesses crept closer together, although they were still farther apart than any neighbors Eli could think of back in Sanders. A few had an old New England feel, but he still couldn't name any of the architectural styles. Several of them looked brand new, as if they'd barely stood up to a year of sun and snow. One had a high, peaked roof, while the two on either side of it looked more like the near shacks on the outskirts of town. A long, mournful hoot echoed twice above the buildings, and it took him a few seconds to recognize the distant sound of a train whistle.
There,
Harry pointed down the street at a large barn.
That's one.
You sure? She folded the corners of the paper in to form the envelope again. It vanished back into her coat.
Yes, I believe so.
It looks like a barn, Eli said as they marched across the muddy path. She nodded.
On the outside.
The left-hand barn door had a regular-sized door set into it. Harry lifted the latch and a wave of warm air washed out and over them. They stepped through and pulled the door shut behind them. Harry tugged off her hat, beat it twice against her thigh to knock some snow free, and tucked it under her arm. Eli took the moment to wipe the snow from his head. Then he looked around, trying to seem as casual and uninterested as possible. The white planks of the barn floor looked newer than the houses outside, a stark contrast to the shriveled boards of the walls. The fireplace on the back wall also looked like a recent addition. The potbelly stove close to the bar could have been 20 years old, but it stood on a small platform of fresh bricks and mortar. Eli's eyes picked out more bright wood scattered throughout the barn, reinforcing steps and beams. An American flag had been draped across the far wall. Eli counted up the perfect columns of stars in the blue corner. 4 rows of 6. A smaller flag hung over the bar, this one with a dense circle of clustered stars in the corner. Colorful blankets and animal skins hung in several places. He guessed their purpose was half for atmosphere, half to cut drafts. A dozen tables and thrice as many chairs stood scattered around the big room. The chairs had clustered at a few tables, as was their nature. A handful of padded, blanket-wrapped ones had gathered near the fire and the stove, although one sat empty and alone in a corner across from the bar. Also across from the bar stood an upright piano, with a set of antlers mounted on the wall above it. Eli felt a grin forming at the sight of the old movie standard, but fought it back down.
So this is what? He asked, looking around the barn. A speakeasy?
Speakeasies are during Prohibition,
said Harry.
This is just a saloon.
Doesn't look like one.
Have you been in a lot of saloons?
He shrugged. I just didn't think they'd be so basic. Eli counted up 8 people scattered around the saloon, plus the bald bartender who locked eyes with Eli in the mirrors behind the bar. A woman in a green dress, an older man with thick silver mutton chops that stood out against the black lapels of his coat. A skinny man in layers of threadbare clothes, younger than Eli, with a bush of red hair and no whiskers.
I see 4 possibles,
she said. Me too.
Let's wander and look a little closer, shall we?
Couldn't we just ask? He cleared his throat. She shook her head.
Word could get around.
And?
He's a man who found a rich claim out in California. If he hears 2 strangers are looking for him, he's just as likely to vanish as to announce himself.
She gazed up at Eli.
We can't have him go into hiding.
Warmer by the fire,
the bartender called out. Eli nodded to the man. Harry flashed him a smile. The bartender went back to dusting bottles with his rag. Harry led them to a table in the back, just outside a half circle of chairs before the fireplace. Eli looked back as they passed each of the 4 dark-haired men. A pair of cards landed on the table in front of a man with a dark beard that stretched down his shirt. A few strands of brown and gray threaded through the cascade of facial hair. He picked up a card and gave his opponent an evil grin that displayed a full set of teeth. Eli put the man's age at 50, or maybe a hard-lived 40. The man who sat alone at a table with his plate of food had a square-cut beard and no mustache. Eli wondered if the man was a Lincoln fan, then tried to remember if Lincoln would even be known at this point in time. He glared when Eli's gaze lingered too long. The third man, by the fireplace, had a sharp tuft of a beard, a Van Dyke. His nose and forehead looked like bronze. A book sat open in his lap, and Eli had the distinct sense the pages hadn't turned for quite a while. The man tapped the left-hand page with 2 fingers while he stared at a stone in the side of the fireplace. The last man leaned against the staircase and talked with the woman in the green dress. He had a thick, lush beard and mustache of black hair, but was as bald as the bartender. He kept talking to the woman, even as his eyes drifted to Harry and followed her to the table where she sat down. His gaze settled on Eli for a moment before darting back to the woman in front of him. The bartender leaned over the wooden counter and called out to them as Eli and Harry settled in at the table.
What'll it be?
Eli glanced at Harry. She gave an ever so slight dip of her eyes and he turned to the bald man. What's on tap? The bartender's brow furrowed. Harry's boot jabbed at his ankle under the table. Eli coughed.
Sorry, he said. Thinking of something else. I'll have a whiskey.
Bourbon?
Yeah, sure.
The man nodded and glanced at Harry.
Just a coffee for me, sir,
she said. He looked over at the iron stove and frowned.
I'll have to put a pot on.
She said.
If it's too much trouble, then never mind.
He drummed his fingers against the bar for a few moments, then tossed his rag down and pulled a kettle from a hidden shelf. Harry beamed at him.
How are we paying for this?
Whispered Eli.
It will only be 20 cents or so. I have some money.
I thought you'd spent it all.
I said I'd spent the Confederate bills. I didn't say I hadn't picked up anything else since then.
Now what?
Now,
she said,
we'll warm our feet, each have a drink so as not to arouse suspicion, and then go to find the other saloon, hopefully before nightfall.
Why?
Her mouth pulled into a tight smile that was only slightly condescending.
Our situation may appear relaxed, Mr. Teague, but please don't forget. We're just one of many teams searching for the dream. They may not be following the same path as us, but that doesn't mean their own investigations won't eventually lead to the same place and time.
No, I mean, why are we going to the other saloon?
She sighed.
Because,
she said,
Mr. Rusk isn't here.
Yeah, he is.
Eli tipped his head back and to the left toward the fireplace and the man with the book.
I'm pretty sure that's him.
No, it isn't. He doesn't match the description I was given.
Eli nodded.
You said he's been back in town for a few days, right?
I think so, yes.
From what you're telling me, the man comes into town for the first time after what, a month on the trail?
A couple of years of mining for gold. He's tired, dirty, a little ragged, but he's got a lot of money now. He feels like splurging. That's what you were saying earlier, right? She nodded. He'd get some good food and a lot of booze, and maybe, he debated a few terms in his mind, maybe get some company, like you said. I'd bet he'd probably go to the barber, too. Get cleaned up, get his hair trimmed. Maybe even get a shave.
Her eyes widened. Eli nodded toward the man slumped by the fire, the man with the tanned nose and forehead, but pale cheeks around his Van Dyke beard.
Ah, she said. Good eye, Mr. Teague.
19. Harry pulled the envelope from her pocket and unfolded it. She reread it, tore off the bottom half, and folded it into thirds. The rest of it went in the small lamp on the center of their table. It flared up and drew a few eyes as it turned to ash.
Not leaving tracks? You're learning, Mr. Teague.
She stood up and moved to stand before the other man.
Mr. Rusk.
He looked up from the fire.
Yes?
Gregson Edgar Rust?
I am,
said the man. His eyes flitted up and down her body, taking in her figure and the clothes hiding it. He glanced over at Eli.
Who might you be, young lady?
I'm Harriet. You can call me Harry.
He grinned and showed off a jagged front tooth. It was a triangle of gray in a row of tan-brown teeth. Eli tried not to think about what a break like that would have felt like.
You seem to have me at a disadvantage, man, said the prospector.
She lowered herself into the chair across from him, creating a triangle between herself, Rusk, and Eli.
A friend told me I might find you here. You're from the South, yes?
Louisiana, ma'am,
he said with a nod.
A Southern gentleman,
she said.
Excellent. I was hoping you might be able to spare a few minutes of your time to help me with something.
The prospector glanced over at Eli again.
It's early, he said, but I'm willing if the price is right.
She laughed and granted him what seemed to Eli like a very fake smile.
No, not that,
she said. He gestured at the bottle.
Want to help me finish this off?
It won't change my mind.
Too bad, said Rusk.
He tapped the book in his lap.
Don't suppose you can read?
I can.
His eyes darted to Eli again.
You could spend the day reading this storybook to me, then.
She shook her head.
It's the best offer so far,
she said,
but still not what I'm here for.
He huffed out a sigh.
My brother and I wanted to talk about your inspiration,
she said.
We were wondering what led a Southern man like yourself to drop everything and head west.
Maybe you haven't noticed, said Rusk with a smirk, but lots of folks are heading west.
Not really,
said Harry.
There must be 500,000 people just here in Missouri. Most of them aren't going anywhere. Most people in the country aren't.
She smiled again, a better smile.
But you did, Mr. Rusk. You left behind friends, your job, everything you know. Why?
He studied her for a moment, this time just her face. Then his gaze shifted to Eli. Rusk stood up. The man stood an inch or two shorter than Harry.
If you'll pardon my saying, I don't like the path this question leads down.
She spread her fingers wide but stopped short of raising her hands.
I don't mean to make you uncomfortable,
she said.
I'm just curious.
These ain't curious questions, said the prospector.
He brushed back the ragged edge of his coat to reveal a tube of scratched leather on his thigh. His hand settled near it. Eli took a moment to recognize the tube. He'd seen too many custom-shaped holsters of nylon and plastic in movies and on television. The simplicity of Rusk's caught him off guard. Eli leaned forward, but Harry pinned him in his seat with a glance. Her gaze went back to Rusk.
There's no need for guns.
Ma'am, every time somebody tells me that, it means I'm going to need my guns.
Well, then, this time will be a pleasant exception.
He shook his head.
Thank you, but no.
We have no interest in your claim, Mr. Rusk,
she said.
None at all. I just want to know what made you travel to California.
And I believe I've been clear. I don't want to talk about it.
If that's the case,
said Harry,
I do have one other thing you still might be looking for.
Favor for a favor?
Ma'am, said the prospector, I've told you all the things I'm looking for. You ain't offering none of them.
He stood up and headed for the bar.
You haven't told me about your sister,
Harry said as he moved past her. Rusk took another three steps, giving Eli a cautious look as they came close. Then Harry's words registered and he spun around. His hand came away from the holster.
What did you say?
Louisa is your sister, isn't she?
The prospector leaned in close.
My sister's dead. The Redskins got her.
Harry's head went side to side. Her eyes never left his.
Would you like to talk now, Mr. Rusk?
His eyes flitted between her and Eli. For a moment, Eli thought the man would turn and walk away, or reach for his gun again.
Gregson?
Asked the bartender. He had the wary tone of a man used to leaping in and ready to do so if needed.
There a problem?
Eli glanced around the bar. More than a few of the patrons watched. The two men playing cards looked eager. So did the woman by the stairs. Rusk's eyes settled on Harry. She leaned back in her chair. With one hand, she pulled the bottom half of the paper from her pocket and tapped her fingers against it.
No problem, Ray, said the prospector.
In the corner of Eli's eye, the bartender nodded and relaxed. The woman by the stairs sighed and returned her attention to the man with her. The dark-haired man playing cards dropped his hand to the table and chuckled.
I'm very sorry, my friend, that I must resort to blackmail, Mr. Rusk,
Harry told him.
Please believe me when I say I want you and your sister to be reunited as soon as possible.
She held up the folded piece of paper.
This was intended to be a sincere thank you for helping me with my own quest.
Rusk glanced at Eli.
Thought he was your brother.
He's like a brother to me, said Harry. We've known each other for so long. Honestly, if a horse's kick hadn't left him unable to perform a husband's duties, I would have married him years ago.
The prospector looked at Eli again, this time with pity in his eyes. Eli bit his tongue.
But enough about my problems, Mr. Rusk.
She held the paper out past her knees, then pulled it back when the prospector reached for it.
I propose a simple trade. My information for yours. A favor for a favor.
How do I know it's the truth? This could all be some swindle.
She unfolded the paper, leaving the blank side to the prospector. From where he sat, Eli could see four handwritten lines.
Your sister has brown hair and brown eyes. She had freckles when she was younger. There's a scar on her left hand and another one behind her right ear, but she wears her hair loose to hide that one.
Rusk's eyes opened wide. Tears swelled at the corners.
I'll tell you where the mine is, he said with a quick nod. I've got a map to the claim and the papers. It's all yours.
As I told you before, we have no interest in your claim.
Rusk blinked away the tears before they could blur his vision. His eyes darted from Harry to the paper.
What do you want, then?
Why did you go to California?
For the gold. That's what everyone's heading out there for. We've all heard the stories.
She shook her head.
But why, Mr. Rusk? What set you on your path? What made the decision for you?
I don't understand.
He leaned close to her, to the paper.
What do you want me to say?
Why did you go? What was the final straw for you, the deciding moment? Was it something you heard or read or saw? Did the thought just come to you, perhaps?
He shrugged.
I don't know. I was in New Orleans doing odd jobs for a machinist. I'd been hearing some stories about gold, about how people was just plucking nuggets right up off the ground. And then I ended up talking to this one fella who came in about some parts for equipment he needed fixed. Talked with him for almost 2 hours. He'd come back from California rich as Midas. Was living the dream, you know?
Harry's fingers trembled.
And it was him?
Rusk shrugged again.
Suppose so. Never really thought of it like that, but... yeah, it was that night I decided to go.
He tapped the bottle.
I was sipping a bourbon, thinking about what he'd said, and decided to head out to California and make my fortune. And I did. That's all it was.
He reached for the paper. Harry lifted it away. His face hardened.
The man,
she said.
The man you spoke to in the blacksmith's shop. What was his name?
The prospector's jaw shifted. It clicked each time it moved. Eli pictured the jagged point of the broken tooth tapping back and forth against the lower teeth and tried not to wince.
Hawkins,
said Rusk.
Frank Hawkins. He'd done the trail when he was younger. One of the first ones out there back in 48 and struck it rich. He was heading back for another go when I met him, but this time he was taking a boat down to Panama and crossing there.
Harry glanced back at Eli to make sure he was paying attention.
If I was to see Mr. Hawkins, she said, how would I know him?
Rusk's head went side to side.
It was almost 3 years ago, ma'am. I don't remember much of anything.
What do you remember? Anything will help.
Rusk stood up and held his hand above his head. He looked at Eli and raised it a little higher.
He was about yay tall, strong, shaved good. Nice fella, but he had this way of kind of staring at people. Had a strong gaze.
The prospector snapped his fingers.
Had this big buffalo hide cloak. I asked about it because it was warm out, and he said it was a remembrance from his first trip. Said he'd never get rid of it.
Harry nodded.
When was this?
I told you, 3 years ago.
Could you be more specific? The month? The day, perhaps?
He shook his head.
It was March, I think.
He snapped his fingers.
It was 2 weeks before Easter. End of March. 50?
Harry nodded.
That will do, she said. Is there anything else you can tell us?
He shook his head.
Nothing, I swear.
She smiled.
Thank you, Mr. Rusk.
She held out the folded piece of paper. He stared at it for a moment, at her, at Eli. Then he snatched it away. Harry waited while Rusk sat down, unfolded the paper, and squinted at the words. Eli watched the man's lips move while his eyes worked back and forth through the handwritten lines. Almost 2 minutes passed before he looked up.
This all true?
Harry nodded.
Edmonds had her all this time?
She nodded again.
Why?
I'm afraid I don't know anything beyond what's written there, Mr. Rusk. I can just promise you it's all true. She's with Edmonds in Memphis.
He frowned and crumpled the paper in his fist. Then he looked down at it and spread it flat over his knee. He worked at the wrinkles and creases with his fingers.
Thank you,
he said. Harry nodded and stepped back to join Eli at their table.
What was that all about?
He asked.
Which part?
His sister in Memphis with Edwards?
Edmonds. And I have no idea. As I told Mr. Rusk, I don't know much past what was on the paper.
The bartender barked out, "Coffee!" and set a tin mug down on the bar next to a glass with an inch of amber liquid in it. Harry guided Eli to the bar where she fished a small coin purse from her coat and slid 2 coins across to the bald man. Eli went to move back to their table, but she held his arm.
Keep some distance,
she said.
We don't want him starting more of a conversation. It leads to questions we can't answer.
Eli nodded and sniffed at the bourbon.
So now what?
Now,
she said,
we need to find Mr. Frank Hawkins in New Orleans.
He could be anywhere by now,
said Eli.
Maybe even dead. He was just passing through on the way to California, remember?
I remember, Mr. Teague,
she said.
That's why we'll be going.
She lifted her head higher and looked to the door. Then she swung her gaze to the bar. Eli looked at the rack of bottles, then tried to figure out if she'd seen something in the mirror. What?
Shh,
she hissed at him, half closing her eyes. He shut his mouth. The murmur of conversation still swung back and forth across the saloon. The bartender rustled the coals in the pot-bellied stove. Outside, the wind moaned on the corners of the building, never quite reaching a howl. When it fell to its lowest, he could hear the distant sounds of a main road. Or maybe a highway.
Wait a minute,
he began. Harry's eyes snapped open. Her hands came up and pushed him toward the door. He turned his head, trying to catch the sound again.
Is that a car? Here?
It's them,
she said, giving him another shove.
They found us.
20. The cold hit Eli in the face and clawed at his ankles under the cuffs of his jeans. The patches of warmth inside his coat shifted, and the ones in his jeans escaped back inside the bar. It didn't seem to be snowing any harder, but what had earlier been a breeze now qualified as a light wind. Harry shoved him again and the door slammed shut behind them.
"Can you still hear it?" she asked him, tilting her head. "We need to know which direction they're coming from."
Eli closed his eyes. Flakes of snow settled on his ear. The wind groaned across the rooftops. As the groan faded, he caught the last rumbles of an engine, a big, monster engine settling down.
"That way," he said, pointing.
"Piss bucket!"
She started down the path, glancing back at him.
"Come on!"
He took three loping steps and caught up with her on the muddy road. He glanced at the buildings around them.
"Do we have time to get back to the car?"
"They're between us and the car,"
snapped Harry. She elbowed him down a different road.
"This way."
"Why?"
"Because if we get too close to them, they'll know right where we are."
She hooked her arm around his and dragged him along the snow and mud street.
"A little faster, please, Mr. Teague, and try not to attract attention this time. Any faster and we'll be running."
Harry turned right at the first intersection and guided them down a new street. In the distance, a three- or four-story building loomed over the houses. A town hall, Eli guessed, or maybe a courthouse. His shoulders hunched as a man in a black coat and hat stepped out from between two buildings, but the man had a thick beard and dark eyes.
"Where will they be?"
asked Eli.
"The faceless men. Probably coming in from the same slick spot we used. If we're lucky, there's only one of them."
They speedwalked past a dozen people, four horses, what looked like a stagecoach, and two more roads. At the next corner, Harry pointed left. They half-jogged down the street. Then she led them back up a muddy road, striding alongside a cart pulled by an ancient horse. Harry went to turn down the next snow-dusted street, and Eli yanked her back. She fought his grip for a moment, then saw what he saw. Two faceless men in matching hats stood at the far intersection, questioning a man and a woman. Their plastic masks gleamed in the sunlight. The larger one's mask and build matched the one Eli had first seen back at the bank. His badge was out and raised while he talked with the older couple. The second one stood a few inches shorter, a few pounds lighter. He wore a vest and dark red tie under his coat. His mask had arching brows, a thin handlebar mustache, and a painted beard so narrow it was almost a line. A familiar design, but Eli couldn't place it. The faceless man's head jerked back and forth, never quite far enough to be aimed at Eli and Harry. The movement looked like part keeping watch, part nervous energy. Harry took a step back, pressing against Eli, forcing him back himself. Six slow steps put them back around the corner.
"Consarn it,"
she muttered. She looked back at him.
"Thank you, Mr. Teague."
"Don't mention it," he said.
"We must be just on the edge of their range,"
she said. She took her tricorn off and leaned out, letting her eyes slide past the corner of the building. Her fingers tightened on the hat.
"What are they doing?"
asked Eli.
"They're splitting up."
She inched back and turned to him.
"Neither of them is coming this way, but now they're spreading their certainty, blocking off that whole side of town. We won't be able to get around them."
He thought about leaning out to look for himself, decided against it.
"So what do we do?"
Harry wrung her hat in both hands, then pushed it back on her head.
"We keep moving,"
she said.
"Where? I don't know yet,"
she snapped. They headed back the way they came, the snow squeezing into mud beneath their feet. Two men stood talking in front of another building and didn't seem to notice the chill. Eli could feel the cold seeping back into his bones, although the saloon had given him a nice respite. At the next intersection, Eli took a cautious step forward and froze. The smaller faceless man stood in the middle of the street, a mere 40 or 50 yards away. His mask swung to the left, to the right, and back as he studied the buildings on the far side of the street. Eli could see the thin elastic and the gleam of translucent plastic on the side of the man's head as it tilted in their direction. Eli held out his arm to block Harry. She caught her breath, stopped her leg in mid-stride. She shifted her balance and stepped back. Eli followed her.
"How close?"
she asked.
"Really close."
She half-turned and took a few quick steps, trying to keep her eyes on the corner as they retreated.
"Close enough to be certain?"
It took Eli a moment to process the question.
I thought so. He didn't seem to notice me, though."
Harry guided them between buildings. They passed piles of trash, a small stable, and then they were back out on another street, glancing over their shoulders as they went. She went half a dozen steps and changed direction, dragging him to a nearby building. Eli looked for a sign, but the window and the door were both bare.
"What's this? Hopefully a chance to save our lives."
A chiming bell and warm air welcomed them into the office. A counter split the room in two. Their side had nothing but the door, a small stove, and a neat pile of gray, gnarled wood accented by a few white pieces. Across the counter stood two sets of shelves. Small jars and bags filled one, all tagged and spaced out. Sheaves of paper and rolled-up maps spilled across the opposing shelves. A few of the longer rolls of paper leaned in the corner between the shelf and the wall. Someone, Eli decided, needed to invent the file cabinet soon. Harry took a step to the side and revealed the set of scales on the counter. Its brass arms caught every flicker of light in the room. A tray of weights sat next to the scales. Each of the lead blocks had been arranged by size, largest to smallest. She cleared her throat.
"Good afternoon,"
she said, keeping her voice calm. In the back of the room, a thin man closed a safe with a heavy clang and spun the dial. He had round spectacles with frames so thin they could have been actual wire. His collar stood up straight, and his necktie looked like a silk handkerchief tied around his throat. His thick mustache would have fit well in any 70s movie.
"Good afternoon," he said, setting his palms flat on the counter.
With his slumped shoulders, the man's pose made Eli think of a Muppet.
"I'm wondering if you could help us,"
Harry said. The clerk's gaze drifted up to the tricorn, then back to her face.
"I can try."
"You know the town well?"
The man gave them a polite smile and gestured at the map on the wall.
"Every square mile and measured acre."
"Where's the nearest train track?"
He shook his head.
"Afraid the railroad's not quite here, ma'am. Hopefully by next year."
"But surely they've sent down some track."
"Station's just south of town."
He pointed at the left-hand wall without hesitation.
"About half an hour's walk. Nothing more than a platform right now. And not even a mile of track."
"Is there anything closer?"
The clerk smiled again.
"Just the one station, ma'am."
"I didn't ask about the station, sir. I asked about tracks. Is there anything closer? An abandoned line, maybe?"
"If it's abandoned, it's not going to do you any good, is it?"
"It's a bet," interrupted Eli, pulling his gaze from the window. "A wager. I told her there wasn't anything closer, and she didn't believe me."
"Please,"
Harry told the clerk, not missing a beat.
"I've got a half dime riding on this."
"Well, I am very sorry, young lady," he said. "But there's nothing closer than the station, and nothing running closer than Kansas City."
She sighed.
"See," Eli said, "I told you."
The clerk gave her a pitying look.
"Hopefully this will be a lesson to you about the evils of gambling."
"It will,"
said Harry, bowing her head.
"Oh, one more thing. The post office?"
"One street over, two streets down."
His finger pointed out at the road and swung to the left.
"Thank you,"
she said, pushing Eli back outside. The little bell over the door rang again as they left. Her boots thumped down the wooden sidewalk, dragging Eli behind her.
"Post office?"
he asked. He heard a sound and wrenched his neck around, expecting to see the faceless men a few doors down.
"Believe it or not," said Harry, "I'm still trying to save our lives."
They dashed across the snow and mud-swirled street, peered cautiously around the next intersection, and then headed down along the wooden walkway. They passed more people. Another coach rumbled by them, this one dragged by a pair of enthusiastic horses. It took a few minutes to reach the post office, a small cabin with delusions of grandeur. A wooden sign hung out front with meticulous letters and a picture of a man on horseback. They stepped onto the porch and pushed the door open. Inside, another counter divided another single-room structure, although this one gave far more space to the area behind. Mismatched stones made up a chimney, and three different shades of crumbling mortar bound them together. Another pile of wood sat by the fireplace, and a single bench, not much bigger than Eleanor's rumble seat, sat under the front window. The man behind the counter kept his head down, his nose mere inches from the book on the counter. Eli could see a lot of scalp through the man's hair. An array of at least 50 cubbyholes flanked him on one side, three hanging sacks on the other. Harry tapped her fingernails on the counter. The man sighed, set a string across the page, and closed the book. He looked up at them with watery eyes. His back stayed hunched over.
"Yes."
"I need to mail a letter,"
said Harry.
"Mail won't go out till tomorrow afternoon,"
the postmaster drawled.
"I'd still like to mail the letter."
Her fingertips tapped on the countertop again, four quick strikes. Eli looked out the window at the snow and mud. Every figure that strolled into his field of view made his stomach churn. A pair of linked memories tickled his mind, being chased through town by Zeke as a kid, and the gut-churning anticipation of getting caught. The hunchbacked postmaster let out a wheezing, attention-demanding sigh. He stepped back, reached below the counter, and came back with a jagged sheet of brick-red stamps and a small pot of glue.
Your letter.
I also need an envelope, she said, and paper.
The man's watery glare shifted to Eli.
Is your wife familiar with the procedure of mailing a letter?
I am,
said Harry.
And I'm standing right here.
Sir, said Eli, it's been a really stressful afternoon for us. If you have pen and paper we could use, it'd be appreciated.
The postmaster wheezed again. Then he shook his head, muttered something to himself, and ducked below the counter again. He returned with a sheet of rough paper and a square envelope.
That'll be 10 cents for the stamp, the paper, and the envelope.
She nodded. He turned to another table behind him and returned with a small black pot and a carved wand of ivory or bone. One end held a brass nib.
This is my good pen,
the postmaster said.
Don't dip it deep or you'll stain it.
Of course,
said Harry.
Thank you.
The man shuffled a polite step or two away while Harry scratched out a message on the paper. Eli stood next to her and read as she wrote. She made no attempt to hide the words.
Urgent. Calling in my second favor, Independence, Missouri, November 19th, 1853. I require passage for myself and my partner. We shall be on the train platform at...
She looked up and her eyes found the postmaster.
Do you have the time?
Time?
Yes. What time is it right now?
He let out another wheezing sigh.
The mail won't go out until tomorrow.
She nodded impatiently.
Yes, but the time at the moment is...
The man rolled his watery eyes and pulled a silver pocket watch from his vest.
4:05.
Thank you, again. At 4:15 in the afternoon, please be there.
Harry signed the letter with a flourish and blew on the page. She scratched out the initials J.H. on the envelope and an address in Kansas City. She blew on that as well, then folded the letter in half and in half again. Her hand vanished into her pocket, and Eli heard a muffled set of clicks. She drew out a handful of round tokens. Most had red, blue, and black edges, although he glimpsed a yellow one, too. Each one had a set of lines and curves scratched and inked across the face. Harry used a finger to swipe through the tokens and selected a blue-edged one. She held it between her fingers as if she were examining a gemstone. The lines across the wood surface formed a glyph, and just as she flipped it back into her palm, Eli recognized it as stylized initials. The back of the J and the side of the H shared a common line. Harry slid the token between the folds of the letter and pulled the coin purse from her other pocket. She shook some coins into her palm, plucked 2 small ones, and pushed the dull pieces across the countertop to the hunchbacked postmaster.
Acceptable?
He held the coins close to his eyes, and for a moment Eli was convinced the man was going to set them on his own eyelids like a corpse.
These are old,
he said. Accusation didn't drip from the words, but it brimmed up and trembled at their edges. Harry fastened the purse and dropped it back into her coat pocket.
Still acceptable, though, yes?
The postmaster studied the coins, then wheezed out another breath and set them down on the counter.
They are,
he conceded. He folded the sheet of stamps back and forth until 2 came loose in his hand. He wiggled the cap off the glue and smeared a small blob on the corner of the envelope.
It'll go out tomorrow on the afternoon coach.
Please make sure it does.
He waved a hand, dismissing them as he pressed the stamp into position. The 2 of them stepped outside. Eli scanned the town, dread rumbling in his gut. Snow still drifted down, maybe a little heavier than before. Fewer people seemed to be out and about. Harry checked the streets.
Come on,
she said. Where?
The train station.
She quick-stepped across the street. Eli caught up with her. Didn't the other guy say the trains aren't running yet?
Yet being the important word.
At the next corner, she looked, decided, and pointed them on their way. They strode side by side, checking every doorway and intersection. Now and then, one of them wove around a pile of droppings or a thick patch of near-frozen mud. Eli kicked a stone hidden by the thin coat of snow, and the tremor echoed in his shoe. So what was that thing?
That?
Harry glanced at the road behind them.
Mule droppings, I believe.
The thing you put in the envelope with the letter.
Ah.
She froze as a tall, dark-suited man walked across the street in front of them. He turned to reveal bright eyes, and thick mutton chops.
It was a favor, she told Eli.
A what?
A favor.
Harry led them back up onto the wooden walkway and down the street.
When you're in someone's debt, I mean really and truly owe them, you give them a favor. They can call it in at any time, and you can't say no when they do. Refuse to honor a favor, word will get around, and then no one will honor one you try to call in, so it's no small thing to give one, and you don't use them lightly.
Seems like an odd way to keep track of things.
Not when you travel through history,
said Harry. She paused at the next intersection to glance around the corner, then they hurried across, sticking close to the buildings.
It's not often you meet people in the same order they're meeting you,
she continued.
So we all have our own marks, something we'll recognize, even if we haven't made that particular arrangement yet.
Eli glanced back, reassuring himself they weren't being followed. Couldn't somebody just fake one if they needed it? They're just wooden paint, right? Harry shook her head.
No one would risk it. Creating false favor would be worse than failing to honor a real one. Once people found out the counterfeiter'd be ostracized, they probably wouldn't even be allowed in the iteration or the paradox.
What's that?
What are they?
She corrected him.
If we can stay alive long enough, Mr. Teague, you may get to find out.
The homes and shops began to spread themselves thinner. The wooden sidewalk came to an end. A carriage passed them going the other way. Harry took four stomping steps. The clinging snow lost its grip and tumbled from her boots.
We're running out of cover. I'd hoped the station would be closer to town.
Eli looked up ahead. A half mile or so down the road, not much more than a broad trail at this point, stood a wide platform with a small cabin on it. About that, he said.
Yes.
If there's only a mile of track, how's a...
Hello, called out a voice behind them. Mrs. Pritchard. Mr. Teague.
Harry launched into a sprint, her cloak flapping out behind her. Eli threw himself after her. After a dozen strides, his shoes slipped on a muddy rock and he clawed at the air to keep his balance. He slid, caught it, ran again. A pair of cracks echoed behind them and the ground ahead of Eli spat up two little tufts of snow. The clearing opened in front of them and Harry veered to the right. The field behind the platform was gouged with dozens of wagon tracks that showed through the light snow cover. The path itself curved toward a set of stairs that mounted the platform. A man in a long charcoal coat and stubby round hat stepped from the shack up on the platform, a long cane tucked under his arm. He waved and called out a few words Eli couldn't hear, then his gaze settled on something behind them. Eli glanced back. The two faceless men marched down the path, side by side, arms and legs moving in perfect sync. They each had a pistol out, aimed at the runners.
Please, Mr. Teague, shouted the larger one. Let's not make this unpleasant.
They were too close, he realized, as he turned back to the train station. Less than 200 feet away, close enough to be certain.
Keep running,
snapped Harry.
Where?
He gasped. She pulled ahead in response, her boots pounding the dirt and snow. Another crack echoed from behind them and a spiky flower burst open on one of the platform's wooden legs, right by the point of Harry's hat. She flinched away and kept running right past the stairs and along the tracks. Eli slipped in the snow again, but kept after her, putting a few trees between him and the faceless men. The man on the platform, the station guard, swung his long cane up and braced it against his shoulder. He didn't have it aimed at them. He shouted something that might have been, "Hold it right there," but the wind and exertion took his words away from Eli's ears. They kept running. The man passed from view. Eli heard a series of gunshots and a wail of pain. He looked at the sloping ground ahead of him, alongside the tracks, and risked a glance back. The station guard stood at the top of the stairs, clutching his shoulder, his body twitching. The two faceless men had almost reached the platform, just over 100 feet at most. They had a clear shot again, but the larger one was turning his head the other way. Beyond them, 100 or so yards down the track, the gleaming cylinder of a steam engine chugged toward the platform. Eli could hear the pulsing hiss of steam and oiled pistons. Smoke billowed up from its stacks, black against the falling flakes of white. The train pulled alongside them as they ran, a massive bullet of steel studded with lines of rivets. The brakes hissed and squealed, a scream of metal on metal, but sheer momentum kept the engine moving past them. Eli counted 4 more cars that rolled by even as he and Harry kept sprinting. It felt like a football stadium sliding past him, yard by yard. Then the shrieking stopped, The brakes gave a final coughing hiss and fell silent. The train rolled on, slower but still moving at a good 10 or 15 miles per hour. A few yards ahead, a figure reached down from the engine, grabbed Harry's upraised hand, and pulled her aboard. Eli heaved, threw his legs forward, and a bullet rang off the train next to him. Another one tugged at his sleeve. He staggered, lost his pace, and heard a third shriek through the air near his head. Harry leaned out from the engine cab, a pistol in each hand.
"Come on, Mr. Teague!"
The Colts fired off 3, 4, 5, 6 rounds at whatever was running up behind Eli. Then the pistol spun down into their holsters, and she stretched her fingers out to him.
"Run!"
Eli ran. He threw himself forward, kicked at the ground, tried not to think of the huge steel wheels grinding on the track next to him. The cold air scraped his throat, ripped at his lungs. Harry gripped a long handle with one hand and leaned out to him. A bullet sparked against the side of the engine near her. She winced, but didn't flinch away. Eli stretched, reached, brushed her fingers. Harry grabbed at his wrist. He felt her grip drag him forward toward the wheels. He panicked, almost fought her, and then Harry gritted her teeth and pulled. Eli got his other arm up on the edge of the engine's platform. Together they heaved him up high enough for him to get a foot on the metal platform.
"He's on,"
she shouted over her shoulder. Steam hissed around the wheels as the train lurched forward again. Eli kicked at the side of the engine as Harry hauled him up onto the trembling deck. By the time he was on board, their speed had almost doubled. He risked a cautious peek back, but the station and the faceless men had vanished beyond a curve. Harry took a few deep, panting breaths and turned to the open door behind her, a heavy sliding plate at the back of the engine.
"Come along, Mr. Teague,"
she said, leading him inside. The engine's cab bordered on hot, even with the door open to the outside. The steel circle of the train's boiler dominated the front of the small room. Hoses and pipes draped across it like thick strands of hair framing a face, each one dotted with a brightly painted lever or twist handle. Needles trembled on a double handful of brass gauges and dials that sat scattered across the boiler's surface. Orange-yellow light flickered around an iron hatch at floor level. A tall slab of a man stood in the corner and leaned into a long lever arm that stretched across the cab. A shirt and vest pulled tight across the lean V of his body. The cuffs of his shirt sat folded above the elbows, revealing lean, powerful arms that flexed on the lever. He could have been a statue come to life, carved from a block of dark stone to represent work and industry. Despite the man's large presence, his eyes met Eli's on an even level when he turned. Creases surrounded his dark eyes, and his black hair and beard were cut close to his head. Just enough gray peppered his chin and scalp to give him character without making him look old. The top button of his collar hung open. Rather than a scarf or bow, the man wore a long 20th century necktie, the knot pulled loose and the end tucked into his vest. Small stars dotted the blue-black silk, along with an odd white shape that repeated across the tie. 3 parallel lines and an oval, all threaded with finer details.
"We're away,"
he boomed over the rumble of the engine, eyeing Eli but directing his words to Harry.
"I heard bullets hitting my train, woman. I felt it."
"Don't be melodramatic,"
said Harry, pitching her own voice over the noise. "You're making an awful first impression." His face split into a broad smile.
"Come here and say hello."
He scooped Harry into his arms and she wrapped herself around his torso.
"When are we now? How long's it been?"
"About 7 years for me,"
she said, squeezing him harder.
"Right after the funeral."
He patted her back with a large, scarred hand.
"I'm so sorry,"
he said.
"I still miss him."
"So do I."
"And I'll never forgive him for proposing to you before I could."
She pushed herself away and slapped his arm.
"You're still a daft fool."
"So every woman tells me."
He set his knuckles against his waist and turned his gaze on Eli.
"And who's this then? Picking up strays now, Harry?"
"In a manner of speaking,"
she said.
"John, this is my new partner, Mr. Eli Teague. Mr. Teague, may I present my dear friend, Mr. John Henry."
21. John took Eli's hand in his own. He had powerful fingers. Eli had never thought of fingers as muscular, until the other man's grip surrounded his hand. "John Henry," echoed Eli, taking his hand back. The other man put his arm across his waist and gave a slight bow.
"In the flesh."
"The John Henry?"
"I would assume over the centuries there have been a few,"
he said.
"But I think I can safely say yes, I am that John Henry."
Eli glanced at Harry and waited for her to laugh. John chuckled and turned back to the engine. He adjusted the overhead lever and reached out to twist one of the round handles half a turn to the left. The floor rattled beneath their feet, then settled back to a low vibration.
"So you led the faceless men right to the Bucephalus," he said over his shoulder. "Sloppy, Harriet. Very sloppy."
"If they hadn't been there," she said, "I wouldn't have called in the favor."
"If you hadn't gotten sloppy," said John, "they wouldn't have tracked you there."
"I wasn't sloppy."
He tapped a gauge and snorted. Harry scowled at him.
"I wasn't."
"Lord only knows how much damage they did to the exterior," muttered John. "It's a miracle we got away."
Eli looked around the train's cab. His eyes focused on the piece of glass above the boiler. The top of the boiler showed in it, along with a few hundred feet of track in front of the engine, rolling toward them like a conveyor belt. It reminded him of the big television at the bar he'd visited with his friends on the night he'd seen Harry again. His gaze drifted to the side of the screen and he saw bolts, brackets, and the edge of another piece of mirrored glass.
"So where's that beautiful automobile of yours?"
John finished adjusting the lever and turned back to Harry.
"You haven't lost her, have you?"
"Never,"
said Harry.
"If you've got room in your storage car and can swing around, I was hoping we could bring her on board."
"Swing around."
He turned to stare at her from beneath a furrowed brow.
"Harriet, my dearest, do you know how much work it takes to turn a train around? Even one as magnificent as the steel Bucephalus? As it is, it's going to take me a week to hide her from them again."
"You're honoring your favor, aren't you?"
"Of course I am."
He straightened up and glared at her.
"How dare you suggest otherwise?"
"Then you need to turn around anyway,"
Harry told him.
"You're heading west, and you need to take us south to New Orleans."
"I'm doing no such thing."
"I called in my favor. You're here, we're on board, you're taking us to New Orleans."
"I just saved you from the faceless men,"
said John.
"We're even."
"I didn't ask you to save us. I asked for passage, to and from. Rescuing us was just a fortunate benefit of your timely arrival."
John opened his mouth, then shook his head and sighed. His annoyance fell away and a wry smile blossomed in its place.
"You should have been a lawyer."
"Excuse me," said Eli. "I don't mean to sound rude, but..." "Well..." John shifted his attention.
"Yes?"
Eli carefully selected a few words.
"Aren't you... made up?"
Harry sighed. John straightened up.
"Regarding my existence, Mr. Teague, if I may use the phrase Samuel stole from me after an otherwise pleasant breakfast, the report of my death was an exaggeration."
Harry coughed.
"John, before you launch into your speech about how history has wronged you..."
"Is it so wrong for a man to want his accomplishments..."
"And it is a wonderful speech. Please don't misunderstand me. But I was wondering if you could confirm we'll be picking up my car?"
John sighed again, loudly, theatrically.
"There's a good Y in Kansas City 1995 that I was already prepared to use. We can be back to pick up your automobile."
He checked four of the gauges and tapped one of them a few times until the needle settled.
"An hour before I found you?"
"That should be fine,"
Harry said with a nod.
"Excellent,"
said John. He reached up and nudged the long handle.
"We're about 20 minutes out from the turnaround. I made up the guest rooms for you, if you'd like to refresh yourselves."
"You," said Harry, "are the most wonderful of hosts."
"Yes," he mused, "I really am."
The shapes on John's tie resolved themselves in Eli's eyes. The Starship Enterprise, the classic one. Another repetition of the pattern was half hidden by his waistcoat. He looked back and forth between Harry and John, still half convinced a punchline lurked somewhere just beyond his sight. John chuckled again.
I think we may have stunned your companion with my very existence.
Harry reached out and squeezed Eli's hand again.
Mr. Teague, she said, you're fine, aren't you?
Eli looked at her and saw the concern in her eyes.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, I'm fine. It's just, this is a bit much.
If you'll pardon me for a moment then, she said, I shall leave you to John's hospitality and stories while I go freshen up.
Okay.
She vanished through the heavy sliding door. John gestured up at the rectangle of glass.
Clever, yes?
He said.
One of the big problems with steam trains is that the bulk of the boiler sits between the engineer and the tracks ahead. This is at heart a simple, broad-view periscope, like the ones Mr. Lake used on his submarines. It gives me a full view of the tracks without exposing myself or extensively modifying the cab of the steel bucephalus.
The steel bucephalus, echoed Eli. His eyes wandered around the engine's cab. Three long steps would carry him from corner to corner. A trio of hooks held a single long coat between them. Dark wood and brass fittings made up the rest of the room.
One moment, said John.
He stepped through the rear door and returned a few moments later with an arm full of split logs. The toe of his boot caught the low door on the boiler and swung it open. Crackling flames and heat rolled out, but John ignored them as he fed the logs into the firebox. He kicked the door shut and brushed a few splinters from his sleeves. Eli cleared his throat, feeling a desperate need to say something.
I thought all these old trains were coal-powered.
Many of them were, agreed John. Until diesel became the standard. I designed the bucephalus as a wood burner, because whenever I go, there's always fuel to be had.
Eli looked around the cab again, then back at John.
You designed the train?
I did.
All of it?
Modesty forbids me from taking too much credit, Mr. Teague. The boiler is a stock model from 1871, as are the wheels. Many of the fixtures, fittings, and pistons were acquired in the 1930s, just after the stock market crash. The gearing itself is my own design, an enclosed variable gauge system for the assorted tracks I encounter as I travel through history.
The train travels through time?
Through history.
Right. Still getting used to that.
And yes, she does.
A time, history, traveling, steam train.
Eli felt a smile blossom on his face.
Yes, John said, one corner of his own mouth curling up. I know. I've been told several times and seen the film twice.
Eli shook his head.
But you built all of this.
I hired some laborers now and then, but mostly me, yes. Over the course of about 9 months. A good time period to give birth to a creation.
I just...
Yes.
Well... If you're John Henry...
I am.
All the stories make you out to be... Well, just a guy with a hammer, who isn't too fond of machines.
John sighed and shook his head.
Mr. Teague,
he said,
as I started to say earlier, I have been the victim of one of the most determined smear campaigns in history.
You can just call me Eli.
John studied his face, then smiled.
A confident man. Willing to go right to a first-name basis. I admire that, Eli. Please call me John.
Thanks.
As I was saying, Eli, the stories and songs have cast me as some brute Luddite who hates all progress and machinery. This couldn't be further from the truth.
He stretched out an arm to take in the gauges and hoses covering the wall of the boiler.
I love machinery, technology, gadgets, all of it.
Gadgets.
Yes, thank you. The point is, I believe in machinery, with people behind it. A better drilling machine, a faster loom, a stronger engine. But these things don't get rid of the need for people, and they can't work without them. I'd worked on the railway for 14 years, half of my life, first as a digger, then as a steel driver in West Virginia. I knew the ground, the rocks. Where to plant the charges to do the most work.
He looked at Eli.
Do you know what my original wager was?
The one to race a drill machine, right, to dig the tunnel?
Not precisely. It was a steam hammer, a large but portable machine. They were trying to sell it to the railroad managers in 1871. 3 drops of the weight, 4 tops, and it could plant a charge anywhere you wanted it. We all gathered around to watch a few demonstrations, and it was true. The rig could drive steel 3 times as fast as any man. It made them sloppy, though. They could place a hole anywhere, and they did. The stone and shale and clay didn't matter anymore, so they assumed the other aspects of the job also didn't matter. They were working faster, but not smarter.
John turned his head to check a few of the gauges. He pulled a dangling rag from one of the hoses and gave a dial a quick polish. Then his attention returned to Eli.
So I told the salesman if he let me run his portable steam hammer, I could dig the tunnels 3 times faster than his crew. He wouldn't hear it naturally. The machine made everyone a master driver, you see. And it certainly wasn't going to work better with a black man running it. Mind you, at that point in history, he was a bit more explicit when referring to my skin. So I made him a bet. The one you've heard stories about. I bet him I could beat his machine. First crew to dig 100 yards of tunnel wins.
And you won, said Eli.
I did, said John. So you can imagine my surprise when, over the next few years, word reached my ears I'd fallen over dead trying to beat the steam hammer. As it turned out, he was using our contest as a sales pitch.
With a different ending. John leveled a finger at him.
Precisely. I hunted the man down, found him in Alabama, and challenged him again. Right in front of an audience of buyers. He hemmed and hawed, but in the end, it was race me or lose all his potential sales.
And you beat him again. The other man sighed.
I did, and it didn't make a difference. He made his sales. They twisted the story, said I died again.
He reached out and set one of his well-used hands against the wall of the cab.
About a year after that, I first heard about the dream. 2 years later, I started work on the steel Bucephalus.
So, how do you travel through history with it? John's brow went up.
Harry hasn't explained the basics to you?
No, she has, sort of, Eli said. Not really. I just don't understand how you do it with a train. It's kind of limiting, isn't it?
Before 1830, tracks are spotty, agreed John. Almost non-existent before 1826. Fortunately, there isn't much history before 1826 either. 50 years, barely a seventh.
But I thought, Eli looked at the boiler and then out at the trees passing by them. The train had been in motion for over 10 minutes, at least, and they hadn't reached the end of the brief span of track around Independence Station. I thought you needed to use these, the slick spots, to move back and forth in history.
Indeed you do, said John. And what better enduring symbol of the United States is there than the railroad? Trains, Eli, are the symbol of America's reach across this continent. That's what these tracks represent. There's not a man, woman, or child from 1826 to 2046 who doesn't look at a set of train tracks and remember that era. There are so many spots along every set of tracks where the dream became focused. Towns and cities and bridges where the railroad meant things were getting better, that things were amazing. The Golden Spike, the Great Change in 1886.
Must confuse the hell out of people sometimes, a train appearing on old tracks.
The Steel Bucephalus is the source of at least 7 ghost train stories I know of, said John, the edges of his lips turning up.
He turned his smile to the boiler.
She can go almost anywhere and anywhen in America, and much faster than any of the other searchers in their little automobiles. No offense, my dear.
None taken.
Eli turned to see Harry standing in the door. Her cloak, coat, and hat had vanished, leaving her in the shirt and vest he first remembered her in. She looked relaxed, probably owing to her scrubbed face and damp brow.
At least none while I'm riding your cumbersome beast of an engine.
John's been telling me his history, said Eli.
John, is it?
She asked.
Thick as thieves in just a few minutes. Should I be worried, Mr. Teague?
Worried?
You're not going to leave me for the soft life of a train, are you?
What? Eli shook his head. No.
Of course he isn't, said John. What man would? But I'm being a poor host, dominating the conversation and talking about nothing but myself. Truth be told, I'm intrigued to hear how the two of you became partners.
We kept running into each other, Eli said. And then a faceless man came looking for her and found me instead. After he left, I went looking for Harry to warn her. The other man frowned and glanced at Harry.
Mr. Teague,
she said,
is from Sanders, Maine.
Oh, said John. Oh, is he? Well, then, that explains it.
Eli blinked. Explains what?
Never made it up to Sanders myself, continued John. There are some wonderful tracks running through York around 1907. A beautiful stretch across the Cape Nettic River, as I recall.
Eli looked at Harry, then at John. Explains what? He asked again. John paused.
I was wondering how you kept running into each other, he said. It's so unlike Harry to visit the same place twice if she doesn't need to.
But she did, Eli said. A few times, that's how we met.
Of course it is, he said. If you're from Sanders, it makes perfect sense.
Harry made a quick side-to-side movement with her head. John caught himself in mid-gesture, one hand rising up. His eyes darted from her to Eli, back to her, back to Eli.
Oh, he said again. I just assumed.
His voice trailed off, and two of the boiler's gauges grabbed his attention. He studied one with intense focus. What? Asked Eli. Images of his mother flashed through his mind, of Robin and Corey at the Emporium, of Jackson's, the pizza pub, and of his small apartment. What's wrong with Sanders?
Nothing's wrong with it, Harry said. Not in the way you think.
What's that supposed to mean?
I'm so sorry, said John. You're traveling together, so I assumed he knew.
I hadn't explained it to him, Harry said. Not in so many words.
What? Demanded Eli. She sighed.
Mr. Teague, she said, do you remember what I told you about the slick spots? The places that slide loose from history?
He nodded. Like the town on the Nevada border, he said. The one stuck in the 60s.
Yes,
said Harry. She pitched her voice soft and gentle.
Precisely. And these are the places we use to travel. Each one is an entrance to a different point in history.
Yeah, he said. I remember. What about Sanders? And even as he said it, the world crashed down on him. The Emporium video store, the radio stations, the lack of internet and cell phone towers and cable television. She reached out for his hand. He let her take it.
We're talking about Sanders, Mr. Teague. You're from one of the slick spots.
22.
No, I'm not, Eli said. Harry nodded.
I'm afraid so.
She shot a look at John.
I had hoped to introduce the idea with a bit more subtlety.
My apologies, said the engineer. I merely thought...
Don't try to take the blame. It's my own fault.
It's nobody's fault, Eli said, because it isn't true. John opened his mouth to speak, but closed it at a glare from Harry. He turned and decided to study the gauges and the view through his mirror.
The Y should be coming up soon, he said to the boiler.
He began to hum a song Eli found familiar but couldn't place.
Eli,
she said,
I know you think we first met in the 1980s, but think carefully. When did we meet the second time? What year was it that night on the side of the road?
He shook his head. I'm not from a slick spot.
Eli, I've used Sanders at least 5 times to travel through history,
Harry said.
Every building, car, and piece of technology in your town tops out at 1988.
Maybe it's a former slick spot. John shook his head but kept humming. Look, Eli said, you told me slick spots form when a lot of people think everything's perfect. The dream works on them wanting things to stay the same, right?
Correct,
said Harry. Believe me, nobody thinks that in Sanders. It's not stuck at a high point, it's a low one. The town sucks. I mean, it's my hometown, and I love it, and I want to get home, but it's sucked since I was a little kid. There aren't enough jobs. The roads need a ton of work. I think everybody wants it to change and get caught up with the times. Harry frowned.
That doesn't make sense, she said.
He shrugged. Outside the windows of the train engine, the trees and snowy clearings had been replaced by warehouses and pavement. The city had risen like bread to its high point and then settled back enough to form a hard crust, one charred on the edges. In the mirror above the boiler, weeds and broken bottles decorated the oncoming tracks. John's humming picked up as he reached the chorus of his song. Eli recognized it as an old Peter, Paul, and Mary song, something his mom used to hum and sing years ago. Harry turned to him again.
You said you worked with computers, yes?
Yeah, said Eli.
At a bank in Dover. And you just drive in and out?
Yeah.
With what kind of car?
An old patched-together Taurus, he sighed.
An 88.
She looked at John.
Could that be it? If he's slipping out and spending a lot of time outside of the town limits?
I'm not slipping out, she ignored him.
Could it be affecting his perceptions?
John stopped his humming with a cough.
Possibly. I have heard stories of anomalies, people who sensed something wrong about their town.
There's nothing wrong with my town, said Eli. Harry started to say something else, but he waved her off and stared out at the city. Turning the steel bucephalus ended up being a somewhat monotonous procedure. John braked, adjusted levers, and then spent 15 minutes backing the train up. Then he moved forward again, and Eli recognized some of the landmarks now on the opposite side of the track. 20 minutes later, the bucephalus slowed to a halt. The three of them climbed down from the engine and into the snow. Harry tugged her cloak tight around herself.
I'll take care of Eleanor,
she told Eli. Caution colored her voice.
You can help John.
Eli glanced at the forest, still red with the early sun, the second time he'd seen the same sunrise. Are you sure?
I survived many years without you at my side, Mr. Teague. I'll be fine.
Then to reassure him, she swept her cloak and coat back to reveal the holsters hanging against the back of her thighs. She winked, adjusted her tricorn, and marched off into the forest, snow crunching under her boots.
Come on, then,
said John. He'd pulled on the hanging coat from the cab and then a thick black overcoat over that. A gleaming top hat rode on his head.
Let's get the ramps down before I catch a chill and regret stopping for the two of you.
They marched to the far end of the train. Eli counted five cars along the way. One, right behind the engine, was stacked high with an immense pile of split logs. The next four looked like passenger cars with dozens of small windows, although all the drapes were pulled on the last two. The final car looked like a boxcar. John pulled on the wide door's latch to drag it open, and he and Eli hauled themselves up. Shelves lined the inside of the boxcar, and stacks of cardboard boxes covered most of the floor. Two long metal plates stretched across the floor, each one almost 2 feet wide and over 10 feet long, with book-sized teeth jutting down at one end. They reminded Eli of huge car ramps, and then John started to move one, and he realized that was exactly what they were. He grabbed the other end, heaved it up, and they walked it to the door. You give a lot of people rides, I guess, Eli asked, dipping his chin at the ramps.
Enough to make them worthwhile, said John.
Eli climbed down and walked the ramps away from the boxcar as John fitted the teeth at the end into a slot on the floor. They finished the second ramp just as the sounds of Eleanor's engine echoed through the woods. The car's wheels spun as it lurched and lunged through the snow. Harry lined the Model A up with the twin ramps, and John guided her with small movements of his hand. The tires slid once on the steep slope, but Harry recovered and Eleanor crawled up and into the boxcar. A few quick maneuvers lined the car up between the doors, facing the back of the train. John and Harry used a half-dozen bright orange ratchet straps to secure the car, while Eli watched from below, poking at the ragged tear the faceless man's bullet had left in his coat sleeve. They returned to the warmth of the engine's cab.
John hung both of his coats and began to adjust levers and valves across the boiler's face.
If the two of you could grab a few logs, he said, I think we can be on our way.
Harry led Eli out across the connector to the next car, and they each gathered three or four chunks of wood. John waved at the open door beneath the boiler, and they tossed the logs into the flames. One fell short, and Eli gave it a kick with the side of his shoe. John pushed the door shut with his boot and watched one of the gauges for a few seconds.
Excellent, he said.
He pulled on the whistle cord two times, eased back the brake, and the steel Bucephalus rolled forward down the tracks.
Wait a minute, Eli said. This already happened.
Harry and John looked at him.
I beg your pardon?
She asked. He waved his hand at the window toward Independence.
Right now, he said. We're walking through town, the earlier us. I didn't think about it then. We heard the train whistle two times just before we went in the saloon.
I would guess so, yes,
John agreed. Eli looked back and forth between them.
I think our Mr. Teague is getting his first real taste of what it means to travel in history,
Harry said. John reached up and inched the overhead throttle back a few inches.
There's a lot of good straightaways in this part of the country, he said, especially if I cut over into the 1930s. We should be able to make it through most of Arkansas by nightfall, and then I can have you in early 1850s New Orleans by a little after lunch tomorrow.
1850,
said Harry.
It needs to be late March of 1850.
He rubbed his chin through his beard.
A little tricky. New Orleans wasn't really interested in train lines in that era. Too much river traffic.
His hand dropped from his chin down to his hip.
If memory serves, there's a few miles of the New Orleans and Nashville tracks the Bucephalus can reach. Work on the line stalled by the mid-1840s, and it's practically abandoned by 1850.
Thank you.
No need to thank me. You called in a favor.
And as always,
she said,
you've gone above and beyond.
Nonsense, John said. There's favors, and then there's just being a good host. Speaking of which,
his eyes went from her to Eli and back.
When was the last time you two had a decent meal?
The dining room took up the back half of the Pullman car with the guest quarters. It could have been a hotel suite. Nice carpet, a few plush chairs, a high-backed couch, a small stove, even a bookshelf, and a small boombox. John had furnished his train with random items that had caught his eye throughout history. Half the cans for dinner looked like World War I rations. The other half had pull tops and brand names Eli didn't recognize. John warmed it all on a stove in the tiny kitchen and served it on fine plates and bowls. It tasted wonderful after 2 days of biscuits and jerky. The three travelers shared a bottle of wine, which John insisted had been given to him by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Harry had rolled her eyes and snorted, and while John smiled at his own statement, he wouldn't back down from it. Then Harry and John had some private matters to discuss, so Eli had retired to his guest room. It had a small desk with a chair, a standing wardrobe, and a high twin bed with what looked like a very modern mattress, although Eli didn't know what counted as modern anymore. Thick drapes hung on either side of the window, and for a brief while, he watched the dark countryside roll by outside. After a few sniffs of his collar, Eli pulled off his shirt and tossed it on the chair. He'd been wearing the same clothes for almost 2 weeks now, since Boston. They needed to be washed, or at least rinsed. He wondered if John had a washing machine somewhere on the train. He pried off his shoes, then peeled off his wool socks and the cotton ones underneath. The skin of his feet prickled at the touch of air, and the carpet's texture felt wonderful. He tried clenching his feet, making fists with his toes like in that movie, but it didn't loosen his feet much, or make him feel like an action star. He spread his arms and flopped face first onto the bed. The wool blanket scratched at his chest, but he welcomed any sensation not tied to his shirt. He rolled over and stared up at the ceiling. A basketball-sized globe of frosted glass stared back at him, its gaze bright enough to make him close his eyes. He lay there and thought about Sanders, the town that never got cable or cell phones or a single computerized cash register, where comic books still came on a spinning wire rack where a VHS rental store had survived his grade school years, and high school years, and college years. Could Harry be right? He mulled it over. Then his thoughts wandered to Harry, and going out to bars with his friends, and Nicole down at the theater, and not having a job when he got home. The thoughts blurred together into a series of warm images and soft sounds and faint raps. He blinked his eyes open. A light chill had crept across his arms and chest. It was still night outside his window, but the train didn't seem to be moving. Two more knocks echoed through the room's door.
"Mr. Teague,"
Harry Stage whispered outside.
"Are you up?"
He tugged his shirt back on, pushed a few buttons through their holes, and opened the door. Harry stood in the narrow hall between their rooms, her knuckles raised to knock again. Her free hand held the lapels of a thick white robe together, the kind of robe people expected at a hotel or a spa.
"What's up?"
"Did I wake you?"
He shook his head.
"Is there a problem?"
"No, I needed to talk to you about something."
She waited in the hall. Eli realized what she was waiting on and got out of the way. Harry stepped into his room. She glanced at the bed for a moment, then shifted her attention to the small chair and sat down. The robe fell away to reveal faded red leggings with frayed cuffs. When she reached down to sweep the edge of the robe over herself, Eli glimpsed the same color between her lapels. "Are you wearing red long johns?" he asked.
"A gentleman does not question a lady about her undergarments."
"He might when she shows up at his room in the middle of the night." She scowled at him, then her face softened.
"Please, Mr. Teague," she said. "This is a serious matter."
"Sorry. Okay. What's up?" Her fingers flexed on the robe's lapels.
"I know the past few days have been difficult for you. Not just the events, but also some of the things you've learned. I wanted you to know I'm very impressed with how well you're dealing with things. So is John."
"Well," said Eli, "for the record, I'm still not sure I believe all of it."
"I know,"
she said.
"I don't think the wine came from Roosevelt either."
He chuckled.
"I've mentioned I believe that it can be difficult to keep track of the passage of time when one travels through history."
"Yeah?"
"One of the great challenges is to keep track of how long the search has been ongoing. This is difficult since the search itself exists outside of history. It limits the ways we can record things."
Eli nodded. "Like with the favors."
"Precisely. We want to honor those who came before us, so we do it the only way we can, by word of mouth."
She met his eyes, held his gaze.
"Christopher Pritchard, Phoebe Fitzgerald, Abraham Porter, Alice Ramsey, Roscoe Montgomery."
He blinked. "What?"
"This is the chain,"
she said, putting emphasis on the word.
"Our chain. Every searcher has one. It's our links back to Roscoe, who first found out how to travel with the slick spots and taught others."
"How did he figure it out?" She shook her head.
"I don't know."
"Seems like a weird thing to just stumble across."
"I know he drove a delivery truck in the 1930s, I believe between New Jersey and New York. He ended up on the road sometime just before America entered World War II.
She shrugged.
"I wish I had more to tell you. So much of this has been passed down from person to person."
"Okay."
"Christopher Pritchard,"
she said again.
"Phoebe Fitzgerald, Abraham Porter, Alice Ramsey, Roscoe Montgomery."
"Alice Ramsey?"
"One of the few who left the search. Maybe the only one. She was on the road for about 10 years, I believe, and then decided to go back to her old life. Slipped in almost right where she left off."
"I thought everyone was in this until they die. That's the only way out?"
"It always is, except for Alice. The faceless men never went after her for some reason."
"Well, maybe I could go home the same way." Harry shook her head.
"I'm afraid not. Others have tried. They were killed."
She sighed.
"That's just the way of the search. Sooner or later, almost all of us catch a bullet in the head, like they did to Theo. It's how Roscoe died, and Phoebe."
Her eyes slid to the floor. "And Christopher," added Eli.
"Yes,"
she said.
"And Christopher."
She settled back in the chair and stared out the window. Eli took it as the perfect moment to say nothing. Harry cleared her throat.
Christopher found me when I was 19. He came into town in Eleanor, scared several horses and two mules, and began to draw water from one of the town's public wells.
Two mules?
My family used the mules for everything. I'd ridden into town on one for groceries, led the other one to use as a beast of burden.
I can't picture you riding a mule.
In a dress, she added. I had to ride side saddle. Or I would have, if we'd had more than a blanket.
Eli smiled.
Now please stop interrupting while I unburden myself, Mr. Teague. This is difficult enough.
Sorry.
He was amazing,
she said.
In my whole life, I'd maybe met a dozen people who weren't from our town, and they all looked the same. Closer to poor than to rich. At least a week of dirt on them. Tired. Everyone was lean and wiry back then, even the women. And there he was. So different. And handsome. 6 foot tall, half that across the shoulders. And he just looked so safe. So relaxed and confident, like nothing could hurt him. He stood there and pumped water like he'd done it as a career, even though he was plainly rich.
She glanced at Eli.
I'd heard of automobiles, of course, but no one I knew had ever seen one before. They were a thing for wealthy men, and here was one right in front of me. I stood there staring at him for a good 5 minutes before he noticed me.
The corners of her mouth quivered.
I'd never seen a man over the age of 20 without a mustache. He said hello and asked if I needed to use the well. To this day, I can't remember what I said. He'd never tell me. I think he liked teasing me with it. But I ended up standing next to him and filling an old canteen that had been hanging dry on my mule's pack for a year or so, just for an excuse to talk to him. He had on a brilliant red undershirt. I'd never seen such vibrant colors or such fine woven cloth, almost like silk. And there was a face painted on it in dabs of black ink. I remember at the time, I thought it was an image of the Lord Jesus. He was one of the few people I'd seen paintings of at the time.
She glanced at Eli.
I learned later it was Ernesto Che Guevara. He was a freedom fighter in the late...
I know who he is, said Eli. Mrs. Pritchard. She smirked.
We talked for an hour. About Eleanor, about the world outside. He'd already traveled most of the country at that point, and most of history as well. Although he was very clever about not letting on.
And then you ran off with him?
No,
snapped Harry, although her eyes brightened.
What kind of woman do you take me for?
The kind who'd show up at someone's door in her underwear at 1 in the morning? She raised a threatening fist.
Christopher was a gentleman, unlike some people. He left, alone, but promised to return. And he did, just a week later. I remember thinking his beard had grown very fast.
Eli nodded.
He kept coming back. Sometimes to refill the main tank, sometimes the reserve. By the 7th or 8th visit, it was plain he wasn't coming for the water. And our town well was awful. In retrospect, he must have been cleaning Eleanor's filters and carburetor out every night. The 12th time, he came and stayed for 4 days. He told me a little about the search, but I still didn't understand what a risk he was taking, staying in one place for so long. He bought some good clothes, went to see my pa, and asked permission to court me.
Eli pursed his lips. This was 1902?
By that point, 1904.
They were still doing that then? Asking permission to court someone?
No. As a matter of fact, they were not. It wasn't unheard of, but it was a bit old-fashioned. Pa had heard about the mysterious stranger seen with his daughter. This made him seem more eccentric than respectable. He asked Christopher to leave and forbade me from ever speaking to him again.
Ah.
It was 2 months before I saw him again, at the well filling Eleanor's tanks, looking for me. It was a week before Christmas.
She glanced at Eli, and the edges of her mouth twitched again.
That's when I ran off with him.
She sighed, a slow, happy sound that warmed the small guest room.
We searched together for 6 months before he formally proposed. 3 weeks later, we were married in the city of Las Vegas, entertainment capital of the world. Elvis Presley himself performed the wedding.
When was this?
2006.
Okay, said Eli. Just to be clear, because of all this time travel stuff.
History travel.
Right. When you say Elvis Presley performed the ceremony, do you mean the Elvis or...
I didn't think to ask.
Ah.
We were together for 3 glorious years. 3 years, 3 months, 3 weeks, 5 days. 3, 3, 3, 5.
And then? The light in her eyes dimmed.
And then we weren't.
A few possible responses went back and forth in his mind, and Eli picked the one he hoped would be best received. He reached out and set his hand on hers. Harry tensed, relaxed, then turned her hand over so their palms slid together. Her hand was very warm. She squeezed his once, a good solid grip, and then released it.
Thank you, Eli.
He took his hand back. She sat up, squared her shoulders, and raised her eyes to his.
Christopher Pritchard, Phoebe Fitzgerald, Abraham Porter, Alice Ramsey, Roscoe Montgomery.
He nodded.
Christopher Pritchard, no, she said. My fault. You need to start with me. Harriet Pritchard, then Christopher Pritchard, Phoebe, and so on.
He nodded, the next link in the chain.
Precisely.
And you want me to learn this, so? She snorted.
For a clever man, you can be quite daft at times.
Thank you?
I'm teaching you because you're my partner, Eli. Because someday you may have to teach it to someone else. You're the next link.
Oh. Thank you.
You've earned it. So.
She shifted in her chair.
Harriet Pritchard. Christopher Pritchard. Phoebe Fitzgerald. Abraham Porter. Alice Ramsey. Roscoe Montgomery.
Harry Pritchard, echoed Eli. Christopher Pritchard. Phoebe Fitzgerald. Abraham... Porter? She nodded. Abraham Porter. Alice... Ramses?
Alice Ramsey, she said. Then Roscoe Montgomery. Say it again.
Harry Pritchard. Christopher Pritchard. Phoebe...
You should use my proper name.
But I know you as Harry.
This is for posterity. I prefer it if people remember me as a woman.
But not a lady,
he gestured at her knee. The robe had fallen open again to reveal red flannel.
Don't be an ass,
Harry said, but the edges of her lips twitched as she did.
Say the chain again properly this time.
Harriet Pritchard, he recited. Christopher Pritchard. Phoebe Fitzgerald. Abraham Porter.